Hello and welcome back to Blood and Ashes. This is episode 73. I am your host, Mo, and I'm joined once again by my foggy friends, Villy.
Very foggy.
And Jody.
Booker. Sorry, I'm dating the podcast, Moritz, but...
That's okay. It's okay. We did it last episode as well.
Did we? All right. It's all a blur.
And, Jody, do you want to just get straight into apologizing or commiserating with Gerald and our other New Zealand listeners?
Oh, sorry. For those who don't know what's going on, the Rugby World Cup final was on last night. We beat New Zealand. New Zealanders, great game. Sorry. Yeah. I was fantastic. I'm sorry you guys lost, but I'm also very happy we won.
Of course, so, yes. It was. That. For Villy and I, who are in Australia, that was just this morning. So we're still riding the same day. There's still the same high from watching the Springboks triumph in the Rugby World Cup for the second time in a row.
Four times in total.
Mm-hmm. Both riding the wave of triumph and the pain of punk rock show the night before.
Yeah, Villy just overdid it. Villy, you're too old for this shit now, bro. You can't.
When I wrote the intro for this episode, it was more obviously about the fog around Torum Wrighton's camp, but it is also very applicable to at least Villy and myself, who are both bone-weary. Villy, because he went to a punk rock show the night before.
And then woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch the game.
It's nothing like a good 6 a.m. shot of adrenaline with sports. Just, your whole days crash from there.
Jody, you are on duty. You need to virtually prod Villy and myself if we start looking like we're flagging, like if our energy levels are not where they should be. At least the contents of these chapters is pretty exciting. There's some wild stuff that we're going to cover here. I have faith that the content here is actually going to keep us going. In both the two main events that happen in these chapters, I had different pictures in my mind. Like, I had imagined both those scenarios differently on my previous reads, and I was just really paying attention to the setting and everything that was happening now. And I was pleasantly surprised. It wasn't like reading it for the first time, but it was very different to how I remembered it. How about you guys?
It was spot on. Exactly. That marquee tent, the layout of the people inside, how the fog comes in. That's exactly how I had it in my mind beforehand. I don't know.
It all came back to you. That chap.
Yeah, that's nothing's different. Nothing's new.
Prior to getting to this again this time around, but no recollection of it.
Really? Wow. Okay, like, so it was like reading it the first time.
Right, it was like a new scene for me.
It's like every three different levels, exactly how we thought, different to how we thought, and didn't remember it at all. Great.
Oh, man. Okay, yeah, so let's get to all that good stuff, but let's take care of a little bit of housekeeping first in everybody's favorite section called Callbacks. Okay, so in the excitement of preparing for the Rugby World Cup, I neglected to do any of the regular callbacks from the previous episode. I do have them all noted down, but I haven't made any notes yet. So I'll just lump them in with next episode's callbacks so we can head straight into the listener contributions that do contain some callbacks. So the first one is from Ian Yellen, who, another mistake on my part, these I was supposed to add in the previous episode, but I'd missed the message from Ian, so apologies, Ian, but here they are now. We were wondering about the making of Kalandor and how they would have made a Sa'angreal for the true power. Ian just wrote in to say that Sa'angreal are made using a seed and the one power, not the true power. Rand leaves a seed with Elaine in A Memory of Light. But what I wanted to say to Ian is, like, we specifically were wondering not about regular Sa'angreal, but a Sa'angreal for the true power, because we know that Kalandor is a Sa'angreal for the one power, the third most powerful, if you take the Tsakanan into consideration. But what we have read, not in any of our books yet, but in the later books, is that it's also a Sa'angreal for the true power. And if it was made by the Aes Sedai in the Age of Legends, how did they do that without having access to the true power? So that mystery remains unsolved. Then Ian had a very good point about the whole Matt Tylan relationship and how we were talking about how, you know, maybe it was of its time and sort of played for laughs. But Ian chimes in with the following. I'm not sure if Robert Jordan was playing the Matt Tylan off for laughs or going for the two-punch combo of A, showing men how abhorrent this behavior is when gender swapped, and also to show that women in power can also be guilty of the behavior to a culture that was just realizing men can be victims too. You know, there are two good reasons to insert something like that in the story that is maybe some motivation for playing out the scene. Yeah, two points of view that I hadn't previously considered. So thanks for that, Ian. Then we have a new contributor called Adam McKinnon, who writes in to say, hello, I just wanted to say thanks for the podcast. I'm halfway through your review of book four, and I'm really enjoying it so far. Having just finished the books, it's nice to be able to go over them again for things I missed. A note on something that was said about North America. As a Canadian, we also use Celsius and the metric system, unlike our neighbors to the south. My only note to that
sorry
is
about that.
Sensible.
Very, very sensible and welcome.
Poor Canadians just being lumped in with Americans all the time. Sorry, guys. Yes. No offense to the Americans. Oh, dear God. Moritz, edit this out.
Then good old friend Aisha Jean writes in to say, hi, how are you guys? Been catching up, but a quick note. I think Matt has to be in the palace so he can meet Tuon and accidentally start their courtship / marriage arc. Confirmed, or at least in line with the previous comments from last time's episode. Also, the dice rattling may be why he stays in the palace. It's a reminder that he can't leave. He knows he needs to pay attention to the rattling. So it's a good point. Like, Matt might be altering his behavior just because dice are rattling. We've already heard him say that he knows that it usually means something of import is going to happen most of the time. And then Aisha Jahan also says that, also, I think the girls said it's okay to have bodyguards because they were rattled by their narrow escape and thought some protection might be a good idea. Again, yes, we agree with that. It was just like the way in which they did it seemed overly effusive and suspicious in its, very much in its delivery. Yes.
The slantier.
Then another new collaborator, Sammy, writes in to say, you guys are using Chuck Norris-type jokes about Sorrelia. So I ask you this, Chuck Norris versus Sorrelia.
Sorrelia. Clearly, but it's a no-brainer.
Yes. Sammy says, that is a tough one for me since Chuck Norris is from my home state, but I love the Aiel. So maybe Chuck Norris is Aiel?
He could be, eh?
That was my response.
But
he does have the
really,
ginger tinge.
Really short. He's not at all. Man.
You get short Aiel. They are
They're rare, but they're there. Well, they're probably just even more fierce.
Yeah, look at Chuck Norris. I mean, he's making up for it.
Exactly. Exactly. And then our poor New Zealand friend Gerald continues his streak with the following contribution. New thought. The dagger that makes you invisible to dark friends, the one that Rand has when he goes to Shial Ghul. If you were holding it, but you were a dark friend, would you be able to see yourself?
What if you like looked at your own hand, or if you looked at yourself in a mirror like a vampire?
Either.
Good
question.
I don't know. We're gonna have to think about this one.
Actually, a very pertinent question.
Really? Why?
Because they find it here with the bowl. I think it's not mentioned in these chapters. This is me maybe misremembering, but I think it's like they find a couple of things in this cache. And
there are a couple of things found. I think there's a mirror, something, can't remember.
They talk about a cracked mirror being carried out, yes, but that's just because they were told to take everything. So Matt's like, they probably, a broken mirror is probably not an Italian girl. Probably.
Just a guess. Well, Gerald, I have a rebuttal question for you. If you ate yourself, would you double in size or disappear altogether?
My brain's too tired for this. Moving
on. Okay, then let's move on to previously on Blood and Ashes. Here we go. Alviarin wakes Elida in the middle of the night to tell her about the disaster of Dumas Wells. After Corvala Beldin recounts the events, Alviarin uses this calamity as leverage to coerce Elida to obey her orders. She sets Elida the task of increasing the Tower Guard, arranging seizure of Tarungril from a set of sisters and praising another set, driving a wedge between their archers and basically giving up on any attempt to rescue the sisters captured at Dumas Wells or warning the sisters heading to the Black Tower. After she has left, Elida can't believe what is happening and immediately hatches a plan of her own. This involves going to see Aen Sedai the next day and setting her the task of investigating treason in the tower and hints strongly that Cian look at Alviarin herself. Cian, however, misinterprets Elida's mission as rooting out the Black Archer. She enlists the help of a trusted friend from before she was raised, Pavara, an uncharacteristically likable sitter for the Reds. Cut to Rand, who is downright depressed. Nandira and the maidens finally allow Min to see him, and she realizes he's feeling this way largely because he thinks he forced himself on her. She sets him straight, quick, smart. He tells Min he'll have to send her away too because he loves her and Elaine and Avienda. She basically just says no to being sent away. She also tells him she loves him and that Elaine and Avienda love him too and that they will just have to figure it out. If the Aiel can, they can. She tells him about a viewing she had of him touching another man and merging with him somehow, and Rand interprets this as him merging with a very real Luthien in his head, meaning he's not going mad like Cadswain insinuated. He perks up a bit and prepares to finally go meet with the sea folk who have been waiting for an audience. He's forced to take a bath with a bunch of maidens and men in attendance, ogling him the whole time. When they meet the sea folk, he quickly makes great progress toward a favorable bargain for himself, thanks mostly to his Teverin nature, but also some solid counsel from Miranda Sedai. However, the small wooden cabin they're meeting in becomes too much for him to handle and he's forced to leave, leaving Miranda to complete the bargain without the aid of his Teverin nature. Because he's having some Teverin luck, Rand tells Min they're going to deal with the rebels. Rand and Min travel via gateway to a wooded area where the Carinian and Terran rebels are camped. They immediately encounter Moraine's cousin Caroline Damodred, who quickly recognizes Rand. Soon after, Terran High Lord Darlin Cisnera arrives and Caroline makes up a cover story for Rand and Min and introduces them as distant cousins from a minor house. When Rand asks Darlin why he's there so far from Tyr, he explains it's basically come down to courting Lady Caroline. He says he wouldn't have let the Dragon Reborn take Kalandor and let things play out if it were not for bringing Aiel into Tyr. They ride back to the camp where Rand notices 7 Aes Sedai, 4 Reds and also Cadswain and 2 of her followers. Min spots David Hanlon and a couple of other White Lions, Ravin's men from Camelin. She warns Caroline not to trust him. They also spot the leader of the Carinian rebel, Torm Rhyton, and his new advisor, Peyton Fain, known here as Gerald Mordeth. Fain scuttles away when he notices Rand's arrival. Cadswain and Rand trade barbs, and eventually Torm arrives to introduce himself. He also states that he is to marry Lady Caroline, but she immediately denies that as a possibility. Rhyton challenges Rand to some sport, a sword fight with practice swords, and Rand accepts. And that brings us to the very aptly named Chapter 36, called Blades.
Wow.
Willy, ek is blade dat jy vir ons opsomming gaan doen.
Wow.
You're stretching now. I'll take it.
That took Moritz 2 weeks to come up with.
Wow.
Man, it wasn't quite 2 weeks, but it was days, plural.
Let's see if I can do better things. Summing up this chapter of blades. Now, thanks for this continuity, because as I just left off in the last episode, we were in a point of view of Min, and she is on this wild Teverin ride with Rand that has now turned into a sword fight with practice swords, which is little lats that are wound up together, and they do hurt if they hit you, I believe. Right, point of view, Min, and the continuity from the last episode just carries on, where Rand has now accepted that challenge from Torum. Min's not pleased. She thinks it's a stupid, wool-headed idea, very stupid, and nor is Carolyn. She's like, whoa, cuz, like, careful. This dude can swing the stick around, and he's also quite a bad man. Like, he does bad things as a child.
He's a shit.
Yeah, she explained what he did to a lad that rode his pony. It did not end well. He got his back broken. Poor lad. But Rand is going to ride his tidal wave of Teverin power that he's, like, experiencing at the moment. Rand then gets thrown the practice sword. Now, Torum, I always want to call him Turak because the two knobs are both blade masters. But Torum has gotten out of his like shirt and his pants. He's fighting in sumo Brooks. Like he's in his practice.
And Rand's like, whoa, this is not what I meant.
Rand has got his...
Oh, that kind of sword fight.
He can't take his jacket off, even if he wanted to, because then mm-hmm. his dragons will be showing. So he mm-hmm. just keeps everything on and gets thrown the sword. And this guy doesn't play fair either. So he just attacks and lunges. And Rand meets his first couple of blows by just moving his sword, practice sword, like not moving his body yet. And then the dance starts. Now, it is described as a flowing dance, and you can only imagine two blade masters act. And Min is recalling how Rand practices with this blade, sometimes three, four men, and all that fruity, colorful stuff that goes on in the background, while there's an absolute life and death, not really, but it's a real battle that's going on. Now, old mate Toram is not digging this and is getting visually angry, the fact that Rand is meeting every move. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's work, but Rand is meeting every move in a jacket and with the boots on and with, you know, his whole outfit.
And gloves.
Gloves, hiding his hands, sweaty, and he's still doing it. And then shit goes wrong. Fog enters the fray.
The end.
The end. No, not the end, but shit really goes wrong. And there's screams and there's distraction, and Rand, of course, wants to see what's happening. If there's woman in distress, Rand's radar shoots through the roof, and Toram sees that at his way in, and he swats him one right on the scar, and poor Rand double over, and he actually wants to go in for a killing blow, like, what a douchebag. When he actually sees, like, whoa, there's a lot of stuff happening around us. And it is chaos, bubble of evil type nonsense. Now, old mate Fane, remember he was in the fray, and just earlier on he was shouting his lungs out for where this man had gone, had obviously now summoned something, I believe. That's the only thing that I can think that this is part of his evil crony connection, bad stuff. But... this is happening. People are being ripped apart. Cat Swain is down. She moved real quick. Now, remember, Cat Swain is there with some other Aes Sedai's. And she has been playing the part and carries on, like, explaining to him, like, look, we'll handle this. Don't reveal yourself in a hidden way. Just you men use your real blades, like, and form a star type position, and they're going to move through this. And Cat Swain absolutely off the bat takes charge. Like, we'll go north. This is the plan. Get moving. There's, we got to get out of this.
So what's happened, like, fog has come into the tent, but then the tent is like flown up into the sky, right? Like, it's now just murderous sounds and chaos and fog.
Yeah, inverted. The tent inverted itself like a flower.
Yeah,
basically everything is just open, and it's just fog and chaos, and is it like they say, it's kakinara. It is like the ruck was for New Zealand today. It was rough. Anyway, the woman comes screaming down from the hill, and Rand faces this and realizes that, oh no, maiden in despair. Men thinks to herself that it may be. He would have, if it was a man, held back a bit. But Rand doesn't, and he throws white laser beams out of his hand. That's the only way Min can describe it, because I think this is the first time she sees Balefire. She hasn't seen Balefire before.
Probably not.
I don't know. Min's been around, eh? She's been around,
but I don't think she's been in a
She Balefire. Knows Moraine, and Moraine was very handsy with Balefire.
In the stone and stuff, though.
What are they called? White hot bars of justice? Who called them that?
I think it was Gerald.
Gerald.
The white hot light of justice.
That's great. Well, the white hot light of justice gets used. And as soon as that stops, and obviously the dumb penny drops moment, the woman that was running towards him for help now turns around and flees from him out of even more fear. So there's just things that's going to rip her and her opinion apart on both ends of this battle. she flees. Now, this kind of outs him, and Toram shouts that, "That's you!" And the whole thing starts blowing up a little bit. But Cadswain swoops in, firstly to PK Rand. A big one. Now, I'm sure our listeners would know PK by now, but it is a very hard slap in the face that he cops and wears, and then says some crazy stuff as well to her, like, "Oh no, he's real." It's like a little crazy Rand moment. I'll quote, "He's real. I'm certain of it." And she's like, "Get your head in the game. You don't ever use Balefire. Never, ever." And then also, she tells Toram to shut up, stop shouting for the help of, because now he's having a little meltdown, running up the hill, trying to get away and shouting for Peyton Fane's cover name. And she tells him to have a, you know, just settle the hell down. Then all of this, a cackling man, as this all goes down, comes flying through the mist with a blade bared and teeth grinning, and Baden Fane enters the fray and lunges at Rand. Min sees this and shouts, and Rand gets just out of the way, but Fane managed to nick Rand with a dagger on the tip of the sore spot. The old ball wound has now got nicked with a dagger. And Rand goes down in a heap. It's like, now first he got moored on that scar with a practice sword, and now he gets that poison dagger blade touching it, and Rand goes into immediate Frodo poisoned by the Nazgul blade mode, thrusting, and it's not good. Now Cadswain is there immediately, and she realizes that, wow, this is like really not good. In the meantime, Darlin is facing off with Fane, who eventually actually gets away, cackling like a madman, knowing now that he's nicked Rand, so the job's done. So no need for him to hang around. He can get himself out of there. So Cadswain then summons Sumitsu. That's like, "I've done what I can. This is beyond me." She immediately goes in and she's like, this is not possible. Like, it's like a cyst. And she describes how gory the healing can be, but it's filled not with infection, but with darkness. And it seems to be two different infections there now. So the two different darknesses that wounded him. And pretty much says there's nothing that she can do for him. But Rand is breathing a bit heavier now, and Sumitsu believes that he'll die. Like, this wound is now enough to eventually end him. And Min doesn't accept that. Min, obviously, on top of Rand, with Rand holding his head and constantly in the way, and her standing up to Cadswain, and what will and will not be happening. Mm-hmm. Now, the funny thing here, and the note that I made, was that how they are just automatically accepted because the knowledge, they don't have it, so it's just impossible. Like, they just give up immediately. Like, we don't know of anything, therefore there is nothing, which was kind of shitty at that moment. But the decision is made that they've got to still move. The fog is still around. Like, that didn't disappear. I'm trying to remember now. Did Toram stay with them or did he bolt? He left them completely.
He bolted eventually, I think.
Yeah, I think he was with them originally until Rand channeled.
Yeah, Rand channeled.
When he
Rand
said, "That's you." Like,
Fuck that
then
noise.
He bolted. But before that, yeah. When there was still fog around, he did have a little blade fight with some fog. And the T-1000 merged and melted together. It's like, you can cut them, but you can't kill them. This was very, very, very thick fog. So not a good fog. Now,
no.
Back to where we are at the moment. Rand is incapacitated. He's passed out. He can't do anything. So Darlin is instructed by Cat Swain to carry him. Other girls, carry yourself. Carolyn makes a nice joke like, don't worry, my darling, Darlin. I will protect you. As she goes up front, he goes laughing all the way as he carries Rand. And they start going north up this ridge, trying to get out of this fog and into some clear light, which feels like an eternity and becomes a living horror of part corpses, horses being ripped in half, like that eventually gets men to the point of emptying her bowels. Just pieces of humans left behind. One dude coming
she
out
shat
of
herself?
The fog. Hey?
I think she just vomited. She didn't...
vomited.
You said she emptied her bowels.
Oh.
It's a shit.
Sorry. Yeah. She spewed.
In those tight pants. Uncomfortable.
Yeah. No.
That would be uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. Let's go back to the real thing that happened here. A horse got ripped apart and a man came running out when the fog was off his face. Like one side was just bare bone and the other side was still flesh. Yeah. And he was still speaking through his bones before he fell down. Like, it's a pretty gruesome chapter. It's not easy reading, but they eventually get a bit of a clearing and they can see where they are. Eventually they can see the city. So, right, we need to move. And she's like, right, road will be that way. Let's get to the road. Now, poor Min and the Lady Caroline has been falling over the whole time, over their heels, over their shoes, over the rocks, over the lot, dress, what works, to the point where she actually... This now Lady Carolyn asks Min about her tailor because maybe she also needs to get breeches. It looks a lot more as a workable thing, trekking through the bush there. The Aes Sedai never fall over, but so never does Darlin carrying Rand. And every time he does stumble, something catches him and just writes him up. And that they don't acknowledge, obviously, the three Aes Sedai being a Taren lord. It kills him that this is happening.
Hates it.
Hates it. Like, this is not cool. But anyway, he's at least not falling down the hills. Now, as soon as they hit the road, first wagon that passes up, old mate in a turnip wagon with two mules that are dusty and flea-ridden. And Cat Swain just basically buys his load, offloads his load, and says, you're now my driver. This is now my wagon. Take us to the Sun Palace. But she wants to set a course first to where she wants to take Rand. And Min then says, like, look, I don't think you want him to wake up surrounded by some Aes Sedai that he doesn't know, because it didn't end well the last time that happened. And
Bad idea.
They get moving and the conversation starts and Cat Swain says, all right, tell me. And Min tells her basically the box story. Sumatsu spews herself then, empties her bowels through her mouth at the news that three sisters were still in this process. It's pretty hard going when, you know, you hear what Rand did. So they then agree that, you know, perhaps it's best we take Rand back to the palace, to his people, where he can wake up in his rooms. Very, very wise move. Cat Swain, though, in through all of this, when the story's being told, is unfazed. Like, she's not even worried. She's just like looking at Rand, like, I won't let you die. And no one's going to hurt you except me for as much as I need to.
I won't hurt you more than I need
to. Yeah, same. Min obviously is very, Min doesn't like the idea of that. But they're now racing on this not race cart with untrue wheels. It is quite the show with them bouncing around. The only person through all of this that is unfazed is Cat Swain. She is cool as an ice pepper. They then get to the palace. The soldiers see everything. It goes into overdrive. Constant shelling is not dead. Careful. But anyway, eventually get to his quarters, to the maidens, and there's a lot of wailing and crying and Yeah, you'll go into a little bit of a meltdown, the maidens. And then Cat Swain does thunderclap. So cool. Like, shuts everyone up. And she barks more orders, takes total control. And things start happening. And then, hearing the news, Amice joins the fray. And in walks, before Amice, walks Kiruna and Bera, who sees Cat Swain. And their jaws hit the floor, and they are submissive and meek, and everyone's just looking at this scene. But then in walks Amice, and they are equally submissive to the Aiel wisdom. So Cat Swain's like, what is happening here? Mm-hmm. And she's like, okay, you two, what is going on here? And before they can please explain, Amice comes in and sends them off. And said, especially when it was for Kiruna, like, Sorrelia wants you. And they very quickly, like, jump to Sorrelia. And that's where Gatswain's like, I'd like to meet this Sorrelia. She sounds like a strong woman. And Amice is like, Vru, you've got no idea.
it is kind of...
She asks her, is she a strong woman? And she placed emphasis on the word strong.
Strong. Mm.
And Amice's response is, the strongest I've ever known.
Very.
But they're talking about two different things.
One talks about channeling, and the other one talks about just being
strength of character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Cat Swain is liking what she's seeing. Yeah. Like, ooh, these women have taken charge of even Aes Sedai somehow. It's an interesting development for her. I think she's tickled very much by this changing of the tide. Now, Dashiva joins the fray. Obviously, the commotion is that he's back and he's injured, has gotten to the Ashraman. And he's like, because Min is also at the stage, like, what is being done for Rand? Like, what can you do? And Katzman saying, look, there's no one here that can do more than what we could have. Like, I'm sorry to say, like, we are the most OP Aes Sedai of the tower that knows about this stuff. And they're not lying, but to their knowledge. Dashiva's like, you know, just get out the way. And with Dashiva comes Nerishma, and they summon Flynn, Dharma Flynn, old mate. The old one, Jody. He then
yes,
he gets brought in and said, look, You've delved into this healing a bit more. And he's like, look, yes. He was very nervous. Now, Sumitsu is now very, this is her domain. She's Alpha Doctor Healer. Lady, what was that lady? The medicine woman?
Dr. Quinn, was it?
Quinn. She's Dr. Quinn, the medicine woman. And she wants
Dr. Flynn, medicine man.
Then Dr. Flynn, the medicine man, on the other hand, he's being shielded by, not shielded, he's being protected physically from this Aes Sedai
encroaching
by Nerishma that will, like, move in front of us, like, look, let's let it go. But, you know, Flynn gets to the side of Rand and he pulls away the sheet. He has a look at the wound and he then delves Rand and has a look and a feel. He's like, whoa, this isn't right. This is like too echoing what Sumitsu had said, like two pools of evil. And so she then, okay, look, he can see what I see. So she lets off a bit and let him do his work. And then he nervously starts talking through why he and tells his story of being a guard for 40 years for the Queen's Guard. Took 15 lances. And got back on the horse and still did it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the story maybe is because he maybe healed himself in one of those that tells a story like, one, he shouldn't have survived, but he did.
Like, this he also talks about getting healed by an Aes Sedai.
Aes Sedai as well.
I think other people were also healing him, and he only sort of like explored his healing capabilities now.
Later. So
I also don't think Aes Sedai can heal themselves.
That's what I was going to say, but that is not Aes Sedai. I don't know if the male half is different, but if we're going,
that's what I do.
You can't heal yourself. Yeah.
Well, let's keep an eye on it. But anyway, while he's doing this, Min can see him doing stuff with his fingers that look like weaving. So he's busy weaving, and he's getting off to work, and he's telling a story, and everyone's listening to story. But meantime, while he's doing his story, he basically completes the whole job, and mm-hmm. then stops his story abruptly before he even gets to any point yeah. end. Do it. It's like, okay, it's done. And she's like, immediately, she doubts him, and she can see what had happened, and she's like, dude, all my gold, my womb, I'll carry your children.
Yes. You will to have his child.
Tell me everything. And he's like, whoa, wife back.
She's like, now, this one. Come and stand now. Over here.
Now.
Like, she not
she
tomorrow.
Starts pulling up her frock. Oh, man. But yes, it's, yeah, she really wants to know what he did, but he explains that he just enclosed it. It was better to shield Rand from it, but the two of them also hate each other. So they're fighting to each other, and it seems like the attention is on each other at the moment. So maybe that is the thing that will give Rand the chance to actually get out of it. So he feels again better. He looks better. Everything is a bit better. Rand is getting better. Yeah. Then
close call.
There's a chance for Rand. Min reflects on Cat Swain and again on the saying that she'll be the only one to hurt him if she needs to, something. Mm-hmm. And then Min whispering that she'll protect him from all the witches. It's only Min. And then end. Chapter over.
Yo. That's a big one.
That's a very big chapter. There's a lot that happened.
Yeah. I thought getting back to the palace and all the healing and all this stuff at the end there, I thought that was the next chapter. I thought it was your chapter, Moritz. But
right.
Yeah. Long one. What happens in your chapter? I've already forgotten now. What is there left?
It's just a... Mine is just a little interlude, really.
Look, it's things that stood out for me here is, again, as I said, where my focus is going to be, not so much on what's happening with the Rand and his trauma. It is, what is Cat Swain doing in all of this? She is absolutely taking charge. She doesn't out Rand, which is a big point for me, where she's like, okay, there's Red Sisters here, one who died instantly in the attack. She doesn't out him. She allows him and allows things to play out. But the minute Rand did some unforgivable curse, throwing out white lightning, she also immediately reined him in, like slapped him, like straight
slapped
up.
Him.
Bad dragon, bad dragon.
So, yeah, which to me is a point against her.
Well, is it? Let's see. Maybe it helps her.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. I don't like immediately it. He didn't go like he didn't.
No, he didn't lash out.
He went talking crazy stuff about his voices inside. It's like, I need to catch me.
Was he trying to? Was he trying to say to her, I used Balefire, I learned Balefire from Lutheran. Do you see he's real? He's not a figment of my own imagination.
Is that
to
how know you Balefire?
I think so, because he immediately, like, he tells her, you see, he is real. Because she said to him in a previous chapter, oh, so have you started hearing voices yet? You know, like all the men that go crazy hear voices. But he's trying to say, he's been mulling this over the whole time. Like, oh, fuck, am I going crazy? Is it really Lutheran's voice in my head? Or am I just going crazy? Turns out he is just going crazy, but he thinks Lutheran is real, and therefore that's why he knows how to do Balefire, is how I read that.
I didn't even look at it in that perspective. Like I say, my focus here was, again, so Cat Swain focused. Like, what is she doing? Like, what is she pushing?
I got the sense that he was desperate to, like, say to her, look, I'm not crazy. You know, like, he's already feeling like he needs to prove to her, and by extension himself, that he is not going insane.
Is Cat Swain Tavirin?
No. This isn't Oprah. Not everyone can just be Tavirin. You're Tavirin, and you're Tavirin, and you're Tavirin. No, but she is certainly, like, she's very influential. It's probably as charitable as I can put it. Like, you know, stuff will happen around her because she will speak up and act and command obedience, whether it's earned or not.
Mm.
What about you, Joe? Anything else? I mean, that was just the one thing, or is there anything else?
Oh, no, there's so many, but I mean, I've done the summary.
I will get to many of them.
You can need your high notes for us there, and Jody will interject.
Did you want to call anything out, Joe?
No, I just wanted to go back and recant what I said earlier about seeing this exactly as I remember it the first time. Because I didn't remember Rand being so bad. I remember him being like sliced by the dagger on the wound. Like that's what I remember. But like him nearly dying, like I didn't remember that at all.
Twice. It took Sumitsu and Flynn's combined efforts to just stabilize him, you know, like even after her, and I've made some notes here, like she is regarded as the best Aes Sedai healer. Now, we've heard that term thrown about before about Dagdara, right? Nynaeve said Dagdara knew more about healing than any other 10 sisters combined or something like that. But on the fandom wiki, at least with sources as like the Wheel of Time Companion and stuff, Sumitsu is the best Aes Sedai healer, surpassed only by Nynaeve, Dharma Flynn, and Sumiko of the Kin, who is not Aes Sedai, right? So Sumitsu is the best Aes Sedai healer. It's still true. She's also possibly stronger than Suana Dragand, the head of the Yellow Archer in the Tower, and also Dagdara. But that Dagdara thing, I think, could just be from Nynaeve's point. That's what Nynaeve says to herself. Yeah. Right? So who knows how reliable Nynaeve's information is. She was just trying to make a point that Dagdara is very, very good.
And Sumiko flashes her skills in my chapter as well. So there's a lot of top-notch healing going on here.
Big time.
So much.
The actual wound, like, I don't know if you guys can recall, when we read The Great Hunt and Rand gets stabbed by Ishamael's staff and he receives that wound the first time, I was saying how much smaller it's described in the books than what I remember it. I remember it being like almost the diameter of like a tennis ball, you know, like a huge gaping round, where I think it's described as like an inch or two wide. You know, it's much more like a
he was stabbed with a staff. So you would imagine it to be sort of a 3/4 inch
round. Like an Australian 20 cent coin.
I never handle cash. I don't even know what size it is. There's a point for me.
But because I'd imagined that wound like that in the past, I almost imagined Peyton Fane's neck being completely within the circumference of the circle of that wound.
I still see it like that.
But Min here describes the wound as no longer than her hand. So it's the length of Min's hand and goes across the wound, which is only like an inch or two wide. It's actually a longer gash that protrudes on either side of that wound.
But again, when we go to the second time, when Flynn pulls off and looks at his wound, like he makes reference that it is a cut on top of the ball, the heel protrusion, like the like from the around, like almost explained as a round dome standing up and a nick on top of that. So I was confused about that, because for me it's like, okay, now how big is the wound? Wondering if there's definitely worth looking into.
Fucking Min, Billy.
Min definitely uses her hand as a comparison. Now Min obviously probably not the biggest person in the room, but still,
maybe
like
she's got really small hands.
Comically small, like a doll.
She smelled like cabbage as well.
Small
that joke makes like an appearance on this podcast with surprising regularity.
Well, stop talking about small hands. Let's go.
The chapter icon is the Ruby Hilted Dagger. So when you start this chapter, you know, okay, cool, this is what's going to go down here. And this is a huge moment in the books, right? Like where those two wounds come together. Mm. Also must be how Rand sort of comes up with the plan on how to cleanse the source later.
Yep.
Because that's exactly what he pits against each other, the taint versus the evil of Shadow Logoth. Huge pivotal moment in the story here.
I think it also draws so much on what we've always said and mentioned and explored, that Shadow Logoth, what's her dark wind now? Mashan Shin.
Mashadar? Or Mashan Shin?
Mashadar.
Mashan Shin is in the ways.
Yes. And all of those together with more death, is a different breed of evil all on its own.
It is.
From a different universe, from space, maybe.
That's actually one of the callbacks that I missed, is you were saying in the last episode that Raitan is a dark friend, and you kept talking about dark friends because Peyton Fane was there. But Peyton Fane hates the shadow as well. He's not a dark friend. He was a dark friend. But he's diametrically opposed to the goals of the shadow at the moment. Mm. So yeah, it is completely different. And lucky for us, right? And lucky for Rand, because that helps, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Raitan not being a dark friend, he is still a dirty fucker, hey? When Rand is sort of like standing there with the practice sword, he goes, oh, at least he knows how to stand. And as he's still saying stand, he's already leaping at Rand and swinging wildly at Rand's head, which is just a jerk move. But like you said, Phil, like Rand's initial deflection is like he's only moving his hand and the sword, like his body is dead still. And this is one of the parts of like this chapter that was different for me. I remember an aspect of this fight being similar to A Princess Bride, where is it the Dread Pirate Roberts or like that guy's fighting and then like he's been fighting the whole time and then he goes, oh, okay, cool. Well, I've been fighting with my left hand, and then he puts it in his other hand and then he actually like dominates the guy. I remember something like that happening here. And I think it must be because Rand didn't take off his jacket. Like Robert Jordan makes a big point of talking about how Raitan, you know, takes off all his layers that are constricting. Caroline and Darlin warn him, this is going to be much harder to do, wearing your gloves and your jacket. And Rand says, no, no, that's fine. And then Rand is still like cool as a cucumber. The only reason Raitan ever hits him is, like you said, he hears a woman scream or something, which is also, again, just another jerk dog move on Raitan's part. Yeah. But Rand, man. Can handle his business.
Lady Caroline's like whispering at that moment to men, like, he's a blade master.
He's a blade master. Like the realization. It's a cool scene, eh? Like when everyone goes, oh, very shit. Cool. Rand can play.
And a shout out to House Damondred.
Yes.
I dig cool. them in general. Yes. They have their own little agendas all the time, but they're pretty cool for nobles.
Yes.
They're not House Raitan.
No. Who seem like a bunch of jerks.
They are douches.
The description of the fog here is interesting. It's not the same as Mashadar in Shadow Logoth, which we read about in book one. So who knows, you know, like book one weirdness or like how Robert Jordan's sort of idea of it sort of transformed over the years. I mean, this is book seven now, right? So this is many, many years. This is a decade later, at least. Because it's described here as like things actually coalescing, like monsters coalescing, almost like those dust monsters that Rand and Matt fight when they're escaping Ruidian. Like it's a similar thing, like these sort of, it's just vaguely monstrous figures. But then also the very first attack that grabs that Aes Sedai is a long three-toed arm that comes down and picks her up and pulls her up into the fog. You know, that's not like a creature standing there. That's something big. That Catswain then blasts with fire, or someone blasts with fire. Is that? I think Catswain blasts it with fire. And something sets on fire and shrieks in the fog, but you never quite see what it is. It's this description of the fog that made me think that story from the Rahad that Matt hears from the Red Arms at one point. He's sitting in the Wandering Woman. They're saying, like, we heard the story about this fog appearing in the Rahad and people dying and screaming inside, you know. And then we said, oh, well, that must be a bubble of evil. At the time, I said, I had always thought that maybe that was Peyton Fane. But Fane, that's Ibudar, right? It's so far from where they are now. There's no reason for Peyton Fane to be there. I think that that one in Ibudar was a bubble of evil. Now, it apparently, never for me, but in the fandom, was assumed for a long time that what happened here with Raitan was also a bubble of evil. But I've always been under the impression that it was a Peyton Fane Mashadar incarnation, like it was him that made that happen. I actually thought there was Shadow Spawn, like Trollocs or something that came out of there, but there weren't, obviously. But this, I don't remember this as being a bubble of evil.
I think, again, that could be because we already know the whole story and we reflect back on it. Maybe upon your first read and reading this, you don't know about Peyton Fane's control of Mashadar.
And what are his powers?
What?
And I think that That, sorry, man, that just brings me to the second point about it, is why this fog is different from in book one, is because book one, it was its own thing, doing only tentacles. It was a base evil, and now it's being controlled by Pain and Fain.
That's true.
He's kind of like a Green Lantern, you know, he's making constructs out of this power.
Yeah.
And it's because he's controlling it that you can see these the different behavior.
That is true. Because, I mean, in book one, it is, I think Moraine describes it as a thoughtless thing. Mm. You know, like, yes. It just
moves around. Anyway, what I was going to say is that for me, what supports that is that if it was a bubble of evil, it would have acted on Fain as well. And Fain uses it as cover. He lunges out of it and uses again.
Very comfortable. Retreat.
Very comfortable within it, which for me is because, okay, this reeks of a bubble of evil event. So let's not do my first thought. And I'm like, but bubble of evil would not be targeted. It would be, it's random in nature. Like it's
totally.
Overflows.
And also Rand sees him when he gets there and then he disappears for a while. And then suddenly there's this big attack, and Peyton Fane is there, ready to
roll with stab the blade with and everything,
shank him.
And again, he nicked him, and for him that was enough. Like, cool, that's it, I got him.
Yeah,
and cackles off into the.
He knows how that dagger works. Always reminds me of that accepted in the tower in the storeroom. That it opened the door while he was in there, and the description of her like bloating and turning black.
I'd forgotten about her. I always think of the dude in Turak's room. Like, there's a guard, the Sean Chan guards also gets sliced, yeah.
Yeah. But fuck him, you know, he's a Sean Chan. No, I don't care about him. But poor accepted.
What else do I have here? So Raiton, cold rage on his face, not in the void, not a flame in the void kind of dude. Rand was always going to beat him. He doesn't know about the oneness, or at least he's chosen not to engage with it.
Oh, that makes it even more impressive that he has those skills and he doesn't even have the void, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's some. He's just done it hard work style, you know?
Yes, the hard way.
He's done it the hard way. Kudos.
I love how when he's shouting, Gerald, like shouting around, and Cadswain tells him to shut up. When he does, it's described as Cadswain didn't seem to notice or care just as long as he wasn't shouting. Like, she is so dismissive of him. She doesn't give a shit. The two Aes Sedai that are with Cadswain are Sumitu, which we've spoken about, the pro healer. The other one is called Niande, and she was King Galdrian's advisor.
Oh, really?
Did they mention it in the chapter?
I think they might. If they don't...
Because I know this fact. I did not Google it.
She is also the one that figures out that Tom killed Galdrian.
When does she figure it out?
Give us dates, Moritz. I have to go find the citation.
She will eventually figure it out. Okay, gotcha.
Yes. I'm stoked that Darlin recognizes Rand's Heron and he gives him a nod. So, like, remember, this is the guy that gave Matt the hard time in the tower. Matt, who beat Gawain and Galad at the same time, who we know are pro swordsmen, but Darlin doesn't have the Heron mark on his blade. Probably just hasn't had an opportunity or the desire to go, like, challenge a blade master or, like, be judged by five blade masters. But it's cool. Like, you can see he knows what he's doing. It's also described here, like, as he's walking and protecting the group and he's slicing up those shadow creatures. He's obviously... he knows what he's about.
Yeah, this is another scene, because remember that I'd forgotten that he was so involved and made such an impact. And my memories of him, he's a dickhead. But now, like, again, I'm starting to just
pick up the nuance. Yes.
Yeah,
the fact that he's like
he did well carrying Rand. He never, I mean, he really, really went above and beyond what was expected of him.
He was leading the Terran rebels against Rand, and here he is carrying him out of danger, you know, like, good for you, darling. He and Caroline do end up together.
Is it Rand? Yes. Because remember, Rand was riding a wave of Taviren into that encounters. Like,
That's why he had that little chat on the horses on the way back, you know, he kind of ingratiated himself a little with Darlin there. Darlin was like, I like this kid.
Fair comment, Phil. It's certainly Darlin is painted as a character that should be at least be somewhat sympathetic to the reader, because you remember, like you mentioned in the last episode, when Rand hears about Darlan's rebellion, he's like, oh, I can almost respect him for just being straight. It's not like Simon and the other fucking High Lords that were just scheming in front of Rand. He made his motives known. And then also later, Rand does make him the King of Tyr, you know, so he's rewarded. He's there at the end in the final battle leading the Terran forces. So I think it's safe for us to like him. He's not gonna betray us down the track. A sweet detail that I never have imagined or remembered is when Cadswain prepares her fire weave, when she shoots a fireball into that thing, droplets of fire fell from her fingertips, like before she's done the weave. So she's charging up a weave and like droplets of fire are falling from her fingertips. That's just a cool fucking image.
I did not read that. Don't remember reading that.
You did. It was like just a sentence.
It's like a mouth of fire's blurring out fire, and then there's droplets of residue fire from a fire.
It's a cool visual, hey?
Yeah.
It was pretty. I mean, sometimes I find it hard to believe, like, okay, Robert, I get it. People are scared of men that can channel. But to run back into this murderous fog where you literally can't see and people are being torn apart rather than be around the Dragon Reborn, who is also seen to be actively fighting these fog monsters that are ripping everyone to pieces. Okay, lady, running back into the fog. Take your chances with the fog, I guess.
There's some dumb people in the world, in fantasy and real life, so.
True fact. Cadswain's suggestion of where to take Rand is Lady Arilyn's palace, the one that she's occupied in Cairhien, which is where Rand and Min were kept by Galena and the other Aes Sedai before putting him in the box and taking him on the road. So yes, Min, good call. Don't take him back there and surround him with Aes Sedai that he doesn't know. If you want to see a nuclear blast take Cairhien out, that's what you should do.
Just reminds me of a moody toddler waking up in a strange place, throwing a tantrum, but the most powerful man in the universe.
Chucking a tanty. I got the sense here that I will begrudgingly put a point in Cadswain's good column, a rare one.
Ooh.
Because of the thing that she said about, like, she gently strokes hair out of Rand's face and she tells him, don't worry, I won't hurt you more than I have to. Like, while that does sound very confronting to Min, who has a reaction to hearing that, you do get the sense as a reader that she is genuinely invested in Rand and that she does want the best for him. But maybe even just in that sentence, admitting that she is going to make his life very hard in how she thinks it has to be done, right? Like, here again, applying her Aes Sedai, I know best, I will put him through the ringer and get the result that we all need kind of way. But at least her motives are somewhat pure. Then, Amys and Cadswain. So cool. I mean, we had previously, when we were talking about Cadswain in the beginning, we were like, oh man, what if Cadswain and Sorrelia meet? We're going to have to look out for this. Yeah, Amys, 2IC. Right? Mm. She is only below Sorrelia, and since their little powwow on the way to Dumai's Wells also carries maybe even equal power or influence as Sorrelia. And here we see it play out, and I was so stoked to see Cadswain take a back seat. She didn't push the issue or anything, but Kiruna, who Amys sends Kiruna back to Sorrelia. She says, oh, and Sorrelia wants to see you again. And Kiruna pales and then shows more deference to Amys than she did to Cadswain. And Cadswain notices that. So she, like Vili said, very much is now taking notice of these wise ones, these Aiel women. And then that comment about, like, is she a strong woman? I strongly suspect that Cadswain was asking because of their own power structure. Is this woman very strong in the power? She must be the one in charge. And when Amys looks at her, like, blank stare and just says, the strongest I've ever known. Cadswain absolutely misinterpreted that as like strong in power, but Amys is talking about the strength of her character. Yeah. And just what a fucking cool little interaction. It's so small, but like just with all the knowledge we have of these characters and the cultures and how they're so different and how they do misunderstand each other, just like the background knowledge that we have, the lore that we carry into that brief interaction fleshes it out for us, which is just great.
Have we had a comment from Cadswain thinking that the wise ones are or that the Aiel are savages, that these wilders and savages.
In that conversation in Bera and Karuna's room, in the servants' quarters, when she like pulled all the Aes Sedai in there, some of the other Aes Sedai said that in front of her. They were talking disparagingly about these wilders. Like, oh, what are they going to do?
Because that would be a point for me in Cad Swain's column if she was not an Aes Sedai who immediately dismissed the wise ones as wilders and savages.
And that's exactly what I think we're seeing play out here, because she does not push the envelope with Amys at all.
Yeah.
Which is unlike
her. She shuts her mouth. She's like, ooh.
And observes.
There's control here. There's something happening. Yeah. This is something new. Like, Aes Sedai don't just bend the knee to Aiel
back
wise
down
one.
At all.
Like that. Yeah. There's the same deference given to Amys than there was given to her when they walked into the room. Like,
there was more given to Amys. Mm. She notices that Amys got more deference. She files that away. And Karuna and Bera are very powerful channels, so they stand high among the Aes Sedai as well. So she's clocked all of that and locked it all away. Something that's not so rad is Agenor just charging into the room and barking orders at everyone and standing around Rand while Rand is super, super vulnerable.
Yeah.
Okay. Amys, when Dashiva and, you know, and Flynn and these guys are coming in, Amys is just like running her thumb along her knife in a threatening way. You know, like she's... I read this as like Amys is like cool and calm and collected on the outside, but in this moment where she is also obviously extremely worried and concerned for Rand, I feel like she is, even Amys is falling back into her maiden mannerisms and stuff. Because remember that dream she had? Egwene like finds her Amys in the world of dreams. She's dressed as, she's in Cardensaur, she's hunting a lion or something. Like, you know, she is a maiden in her dreams. And that it's, her past is still there a little bit. And yeah, in this moment where she's really worried about what these male channelers are doing around Rand, who is incredibly vulnerable, she's running her finger along her belt knife. I mean, she's a powerful channeler. And here she is, like, touching her knife.
You can take the wise one out of the maidens, but you can't take the maiden out of the wise one.
Exactly.
It's the same with Avienda.
Narishma doesn't look scared despite being young. Just a man confidently waiting for those women to show themselves his enemies. Like, he's in a room full of Aes Sedai and channelers and he doesn't look scared. He's just like waiting, like, oh, are you going to make a move on me? Because then I will also act.
You know, that's hectic. Give me an excuse.
Oh, so good. And then Flynn, like, I mean, here we get the mention that it's Dashiva that pushed Flynn to study healing. So Agenor has said to Flynn, why don't you explore this specific avenue of channeling? And I was wondering if it's Agenor's inner scientist that can't not do it. He was a biologist before, right? So he's like, oh, you've got experiment. Go do, you know, push ahead in your research, because that's what Agenor was doing, researching, and that's how he invented all the Trollocs and Fades and what are Jumari? What are the worms called?
Jumanjis.
Almost a Jumanji. Jumara. That's it.
All right, they'll be Jumanjis from now on.
And then the last thing I'll say is that that story that Flynn tells is so cool. Like, I love that he's got his own little quirk. It's not a block, so to speak, but he does ask everyone in the room, do you mind if I speak while I do this? Because it helps me concentrate. And then he goes into the story. And it's quite an interesting story about his whole life. 40 years in the Queen's Guard, 15 times he's taken a lance, and like he's had to be healed. It's why he's got a limp now. He finally got hurt so badly that he couldn't be a guard anymore. And now when he heard there's an opportunity to go to the Black Tower, he wanted to go specifically for learning how to heal. And then Agenor is the person that pushes him along. And then he saves Rand's life using the skills he learned at Agenor's behest. It's just like such a cool little passage. And like Phil, you said, like, he's busy telling his story, but when he's done, he just stops the story abruptly because he wasn't actually there. Everyone's hanging on every word. Like, I got the sense that everyone's listening to his story, and then he just stops. Like, okay, no, I'm done now. Very cool scene. Just loved it.
Is that, tell us about the golf shoes. What was that line from?
Tell us about the fucking golf shoes.
Yeah, like, finish the story.
Vili, one of the other callbacks that I neglected to do this week is you had said in the previous episode that of the Aes Sedai that had escaped and were healed, that Flynn heals. Okay, so there were some of the Aes Sedai that were stilled during Dumai's Wells, that Flynn had healed them. That's still coming. He hasn't done that yet, but he does heal them. And Katarin, or was it Katarin that escaped, the Black Archer sister that escaped, hasn't escaped yet. She escapes from, not from Dumai's Wells, but from capture in the Aiel camps. She's under their watch because she was a Tower sister, so the Aiel have her under control.
She escapes later.
And a dark friend lets her, helps her escape, so she actually gets away. I think she actually goes back to the Tower and starts causing more shit over there.
Plausible.
All right. So that's everything from me. Anything else there? That's a big, big chapter. Watershed moment. All right. Then let's move along to chapter 37 called A Note from the Palace. And it turns out this will be quite a personal note from yours truly.
Hmm.
This chapter is pretty short and it just plays out in the courtyard or the gate in front of the Tarrasin Palace stable yards as our heroes prepare to go get that bowl of the winds from the Rahad. It's the morning after the Festival of Birds, the very next morning after Elaine and the Aes Sedai waltz into the kin's home and Matt joined them, claiming to have found the bowl. Matt is heading towards the courtyard outside the palace and is painfully aware of the knowing looks and smiles from the staff. Everyone knows about his relationship with Tylan and it makes him deeply uncomfortable. He's even holding his sword spear as if he'll need to defend himself. He's so on edge. Here we learn that it's Birgitta that told Matt before this event that it's called an Ashendari or Ashendare, however you want to pronounce it. I looked for a pronunciation online, couldn't find it. Matt's sword spear. I'll keep it in the common tongue. And when he arrives to the sort of the stable yard or just outside the stable yard area, he sees there are six coaches being prepared for their mission. Nalesian, a couple of Red Arms playing dice, and Vannon apparently asleep on a barrel are all already there. I love that. Just by adding the word apparently, you learn so much about Vannon, right? Like Vannon apparently asleep. Oh, okay, cool. Vannon is keeping an eye on things or just to listen out because later they talk about him and he's actually got his eyes closed. So he's just listening and then when something happens, he perks up and then he goes back to quote unquote sleep again.
Sleeping. Vannon is so cool.
I love him. Yeah. Also present is Elaine and Rhianne Corley and a couple other women of the kin, notably with red belts. So these are wise women. Elaine is explaining to Rhianne why they don't need to drag all the Aes Sedai across the water to the Rahad, but Rhianne is hung up on the fact that the Aes Sedai think that the kin are liars. The Aes Sedai doth protest too much, calling the kin's women liars to their face about their numbers and especially their age. I feel like they are so shocked by the news that they're like just lashing out and calling them liars to their face, which is a pretty serious allegation. But Elaine says to Rhianne at one point, no Aes Sedai since the breaking have lived as long as the women in the kin. It's just now dawning on me how proud and entitled the Aes Sedai must have felt about their age. Right? So for as long as they've known, Aes Sedai live longer than everyone else. Like significantly longer. This is a point of pride, right? It's part of their identity. So they would have felt that to their bones for like thousands of years. They know this as, you know, irrefutable fact. To learn now that you are not even close to getting as old as another group would be really challenging to the Aes Sedai. What else have they been wrong about? You know, they believed this. This is like a cornerstone of their beliefs about themselves, like their whole identity. And oops, that's not true. So what else is not true, right? So they
oh, so much.
Yes, Jesus.
Most of it.
Yes. But I mean, they must be really shaken. And it obviously it shows, like just the fact that one of the Aes Sedai actually fainted, you know, the cool, calm Aes Sedai at the kinswoman in the last episode, one fainted when they tell of their numbers and their age. I was just thinking about the Aes Sedai, just wait until you meet the wise ones. So, you know, no Othrod swearing for them either. We've heard in a previous chapter about Sorrelia, like trying to, you know, marry Egwene off to like her great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson or something, you know, like she lists a number of generations that would be suitable. But even Rhianne Corley and the kin themselves struggle to believe it. They don't understand what that could mean because they even respond with like when Elaine says that about them not being getting that old since the breaking, Rhianne's reaction is like, surely that isn't true because that's something that they also believed of the Aes Sedai. Like the kinswoman put the Aes Sedai up on this pedestal. And to learn now that all the kinswomen basically are older than all the living Aes Sedai is shocking to them because now it challenges everything that they believed as well. So this is why
like
you see
the entire knitting circle is older than anyone known to have lived in the tower.
I had to double take that statement as well. Like I went and I read it again. It is like the whole knitting circle.
The whole knitting circle is older than any Aes Sedai has ever been. Like the in not collectively, individually.
Yes,
all of them.
So anyway, Matt thinks about how Tylan makes him feel quote unquote helpless, but that seems ridiculous. But when he looks up at the windows with the finely wrought iron shades and carved wooden ones, I assume he's looking to see if Tylan is watching him or anyone else for that matter. He's like looking up like they can see me from here. Now, I could swear there's a part in the books where a golem is looking out at the girls from a window like that. And I wonder if it is the Tarrasin Palace. I was sort of waiting. I was like, oh, he's talking about the wrought iron windows. I'm waiting for the next chapter to start with the golem standing there, like looking down. And I'm pretty sure in that... This is a memory that I have, probably completely incorrect, but I have a memory of the golem standing at one of these wrought iron windows, spying on, I think it's Avienda and the girls, maybe on the way to the farm. There's a gateway involved, something like that. And
wow.
And a pool of blood on the ground. That's what just I remember.
Snatches of random things.
Exactly. Just like this like fever dream that I have of this. It's like literally just an image of this specific scene. So I'm like reading about Matt looking at these windows. I had that flashback and I want to see if it eventuates or not.
That sounds like it could be after he's killed Tylan and there would be a pool of blood. And perhaps. Then he's standing in the room looking out of the window as they are leaving or something.
Maybe.
It sounds plausible, Moritz.
My only issue I see with my vision is that the golem actually drinks blood. So is it spilling its food all over the floor? It should have drained. Maybe it drained the body of blood. Maybe that's what I remember. Blood is not there, conspicuously absent. Anyway, Matt just barges into Elaine and Rianne's conversation, asking where Tom, Julian, Nynaeve, and Birgitta are, and he's in a hurry to get out of there. Matt is astute enough to realize that Elaine must choose now how to interact with him in front of the kin. Like he's in his head commenting on like, okay, which version of Elaine am I going to get? And then he marks that. She settles into a chin in the air, daughter air in near full bloom. Not the full thing, but like near full bloom.
Mm.
It's like, okay, cool. Is this the Elaine I'm going to get now? Elaine tells him that Tom, Julian, Avienda, and Birgitta are watching Carradine's palace. And Nynaeve will be there shortly. She suggests that Matt stay at the palace, that his guards are more than enough protection. Matt hates that idea and can't believe that they're continuing with this Carradine malarkey and rants about how when they find the ball, they're making a gateway and getting the hell out of Dodge. Elaine informs him that even once they have found the ball, they will remain in Ibudar until they have used it, while the kin all glare at Matt like he's some kind of reprobate. Matt immediately equates more time in Ibudar with more time at Tylan's mercy, and it stresses him out to the point where he's fingering the scarf at his neck, like almost implying like he's starting to feel strangled, like he's getting nervous and he's tugging at his scarf. Yeah.
Is it getting hot in here? Is it just me?
And then being reminded that that was the scarf that she used the night before to tie his hands.
To tie him up, exactly. Yeah. Yes. So he gets desperate when he hears this and he blows it by mentioning Rand giving the throne to Elaine. But before Elaine can explode on him, a palace servant arrives with a package for Matt from Queen Tylan. It's a basket of food, which she delivers along with the message, you did not eat breakfast and you must maintain your strength. You know, like she says this to Matt. And there can be no ambiguity about what she means because apparently the same woman brought up their supper the night before while Matt was trying to hide under the silk sheet. So like he is freaked out by the fact that everyone knows about it. They're just talking about it openly. He's like, guys, stop talking about this. Don't draw any more attention to this. Who else knows? But when Elaine offers again that maybe he should stay and that the queen just loves his company, he grabs the basket and he storms off. Matt's ego is so fragile that being given food by the queen and told to maintain his strength makes him embarrassed. And I was just thinking, just own it, you doofus. Like, you're supposed to be this, like, this cad. Just lean into it.
Mm.
As Matt then rounds one of the coaches, he runs into Beslan sitting there examining his sword near Nalesian. Beslan is primed and ready for fun, but Nalesian seems tired from partying the night before and he seems disappointed to be leaving when there are sea folk women around. Apparently, when Nynaeve returned from the Seafolk ship the previous night, she had brought a couple of these Seafolk women with her. And then, as if summoned, Nynaeve arrives at the coaches, but not before Matt notices two of his red arms are not present. He thinks that maybe Nynaeve kept them with her, but we know they are the ones that were balefied. Matt's jaw drops when he notices the arm Nynaeve is holding onto belongs to Lan and that she is staring moon-eyed up at him. When she realizes she's in plain sight of everyone, she basically orders Lan to go join the rest of the men, and he complies with an "as you say." She stares after him in wonder, Matt thinking it's probably because he's complied so meekly, but it's probably also a bit of that and "holy shit, I married this guy yesterday," which Matt would not know about yet. And then Nynaeve immediately starts shouting orders. Okay, so Nynaeve's block is gone. Doesn't have to be mad all the time. Doesn't need to be shouting at everyone all the time. Now, this is a point deduction for Nynaeve for being rude when she didn't need to be. She can't use the excuse of having to stay mad, but I think she's also a little bit embarrassed about maybe being observed as being moon-eyed over Lan. Like, she's trying to divert attention from, you know, how she was perceived just before. Matt climbs into the third coach with Lan, Beslan, and Nalesian and immediately asks Lan where he's been and why he's letting Nynaeve boss him around like that. And Lan tells him that he and Nynaeve were married on a Seafolk ship last night. And when he mentions the Seafolk having a few surprises for the newlyweds, it brings a little half smile to his face. My note is a slight smile on Lan. The sky might as well have opened and the oceans boiled. You know, like a smile on Lan. Huge.
That was some kinky shit that the Seafolk are into and made him smile.
It must have been. Not even Morel could get a smile out of it.
No.
And she was
wearing his sex pants.
Matt is astounded. Lan married to Nynaeve? Only a fool married, and only a madman would marry Nynaeve.
But he wisely keeps that to himself.
He does. Nalesian, who has had a lot of Nynaeve's company, thinks Lan is also insane for marrying her, mumbling something under his breath. But of course, Nalesian would think that, like, he and Nynaeve did not get along. Lan also tells Matt that despite Nynaeve wanting to keep it a secret, Matt should know that Mogedion attacked Nynaeve and killed two of his men, the two that are missing. Nynaeve thinks that Mogedion is gone, or else she would have attacked again by now, but Lan is not convinced, which is why he's telling Matt. Beslan and Nalesian seem somewhat taken aback, but neither is shocked. You know, by now, both have spent enough time around Matt to expect anything at all, but they're both like, oh, fuck, Mogedion. Okay, I guess. Then when Matt mumbles, "those bloody flaming women," Lan immediately says something along the lines of, "I hope you're not talking about my wife." And Matt responds with, "no, just Elaine and the kin." what other woman can I... the kin. Yeah, Elaine and the kin.
Yes, those ones.
Yes. He knows what Lan is like and what he's capable of. And in that moment, Lan looks even harder than he did last time Matt saw him, if that's even possible. Matt feels at least a little safe against Mogedion thanks to the Foxhead Medallion, but he knows that won't protect Nalesian and his men, or Beslan for that matter. Beslan breaks Matt from his thoughts when he asks if Matt is going to read the note from his mother. Matt hadn't even noticed there was one, but when he reads it, it makes his heart sink. Tylan is going to have his things moved to her apartments. Much more convenient. Rizal will move into his old rooms to look after Alva, so no more human shield. She's also going to have new clothes made for Matt to show off his physique, specifically his butt. She also asks who the daughter of the Nine Moons could be, since he mentioned she made him think of her. She's contrived some delicious way to make him tell her. The other men wait expectantly to hear what was in the note, but Matt just brushes it off as the queen thinking he needs new clothes. He immediately pulls his hat down and proclaims that he'll take a nap, just to avoid their looks and questions. At least with his medallion, he has some protection against Mogedion. Matt would rather face Mogedion than Tylan.
Yeah.
This ends with, Matt is so upset, he feels like he might just start to cry. And I believe him.
Yeah.
The end.
Poor Matt. Poor, poor Matt.
What did you want to say about Mogedion, Will?
No. I mean, like, he'd rather face Mogedion with the medallion. She could still do a lot of things to him.
That says a lot.
Out, yeah, it says a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah, anything you guys want to add in there? I've sprinkled my little notes in amongst those things.
Oh, that's actually a quick rapid-fire laugh at Matt. It's just a laughing at Matt, laugh at Nalesian.
It is.
He's so hungover.
I wonder if it's like a bit of a 1-2 punch, like they're setting you up with a bit of levity for what is going to be carnage in this next chapter, which is going to be...
It is exactly that.
Yes. All right, so let's get to that chapter, which is chapter 38, called Six Stories. Why don't you tell us a six story, Joe?
Okay. That's not where I thought you were going to go, but that's even better. Well done. Okay, yeah, so we're back with Matt in the coach, and he is losing his shit at how slow they are moving through the city. He's ready to get out and pull the coach himself. The streets are packed with people and coaches. The canals are packed with barges. It's noisy. It's hot. We get it. Matt's thinking that everyone's making up for lost time after all their fiestas, you know, so constantly having yes. parties. Tomorrow, there's another one, the Feast of Embers. And then 2 days after that, there's Madden's Day, who was the founder of the city. And then there's the Feast of the Half Moon after that. So he's right. It's like everybody's just constantly having fiesta days and they have to make up for it in between. Matt's hungry and he's brought himself some cheese. And that gift basket that he got for food has raw oysters in it.
Yep.
She packed him raw oysters for the road.
Just a little 40 snack degree heat to perk him up. 40 degree heat, raw oysters.
Yes.
That will sure like, perk him up.
I don't know if she's trying, perk him up or kill him from food poisoning.
It's an aphrodisiac.
One of could happen. Yes, I know. That's why I said perk him up. But I was trying to be subtle, Moritz. But that's not my forte, is it? I won't do it again. When they finally stop, Matt is in a mood now because he hasn't been napping, as you know. Mm-hmm. And he's heading to Nynaeve and Elaine's coach. He's going to give them a piece of his mind because, you know, Lan just told him about his dead red arms and Mogideon and all this shit. And he's like, listen. Then he notices Lan also moving with him and he decides, okay, maybe not Nynaeve. She'll get slightly less of what I'm going to say. But Elaine's going to totally get it. When Lan and Matt approach the girls, they catch a piece of their conversation about Lan and hers last night there. Mm-hmm. And there's much eye widening and face blushing, etc., etc. Lan doesn't give a shit if she talks about it. He doesn't give a crap. And he offers her his arm and off they go. So Matt's left with old Miss Nose in the air. And he's just about to dive into his speech that he's prepared to give her all that shit. And she dives into hers, poking her fingers into his chest, admonishing him about taking advantage of the queen. Because apparently there was red flowers somewhere. Were the red flowers on the basket of food? I can't remember where the flowers come in.
Yes,
there was.
So apparently they told her. That,
there was red flowers wrapped around the handle of the basket. And that supposedly has some meaning.
It has a meaning that there they are, bumping uglies. Uh-huh. So, yes. So she's so pissed that she starts taking back all the promises that she made him. She can't keep promises to a piece of shit man like him and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, what? Me? Take advantage of her? So he sets the record straight. In fewer words, I'm doing it. And she thinks it's hilarious. Strange. Miss Nose in the air. A minute ago, you thought it was repulsive when he was the one. But anyway, we'll let that lie. He's just pfft, women. And like the legend he is, he offers up his foxhead medallion to either her or Nynaeve. Mm-hmm. And Elaine is like, what the fuck? She's busy walking away. She stops dead in her tracks. And he goes, oh, yes, because I know about Mogideon and the two red arms that I sent with you guys. And you guys were keeping it a secret. So, but because... there's some random guy on the docks that's so shocked at hearing Mogideon's name that he loses his balance and falls into the canal.
Uh-huh.
It's just
more
like
comedy.
There's these little scenes that I love, like just random background. Yeah. You know, it's like you hear a cat falling.
Didn't that happen in one of the books? Didn't someone pour water on a cat?
Yes, totally. I think it was in Saladar.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's these little, like, background things that are, that, you know, just add these levels. It's wonderful. So Matt is pissed off about the two men he sent with who are now, who are dead in the past, even further back. It's confusing. Pissed at the women, at the girls, for keeping the secret after all their promises they made him that they were not going to tell him about this. But then again, it happened very recently, and they really haven't seen each other. And Matt has been, you know, busy with Tylan. He's been preoccupied. But still, you know, they should have told him. So Elaine gives him back the medallion. She puts it back, the cord back over his head. She won't wear it if Nynaeve doesn't have one. And he'll need it more if Mogideon does show up. So she's like, dude, you will not believe what I would have given to study this thing. But she gives it up for him. Mm-hmm. And she wants, and she won't leave Nynaeve, you know, unprotected like this. So there's everyone's being awesome to each other at the moment. Mm. Except for Elaine, she's still kind of smirking a bit about the whole Tylan sexing him up. But anyway,
did you cover this bit where Matt says to her, "Me take advantage of her," and then just like he steamrolls her completely, and he just blurts the whole story out.
Yeah, that's what I said. I just paraphrased it into like two sentences.
Okay.
So so realizing how much of an awesome guy Matt is, Elaine apologizes for laughing at him about Tylan. Calls him a worthy subject. She says, "I forget sometimes that you want my subjects," and he's like, "Fuck, what? Whatever. I'm just gonna let that one slide." Uh-huh. She even offers to help with Tylan, but he's like, "No. I think I got enough people with their nose in my business. I'll take care of it myself. Don't worry about it." Mm-hmm. So after their little chat, they head to the barges to continue the rest of the way. Matt and the O's will have to take the next boat as usual. So they get into their own barge, and basically it's like a follow that cab situation, and off they sweep. Matt, watching the barge ahead, there's like a little montage of stuff because he can't hear anything, and you can see what's happening of Nynaeve. First, she's like there trying to explain something to Lan. Looks like she's embarrassed and explaining to him, and he's like with his arms folded, very serious. And then she's puking over the side, and this is all happening. I just had this like view from Matt's perspective, and like within utter silence, can't figure out what's going on, and all these little scenes are playing out on the other boat while Matt's on his side eating his block of cheese. Apparently they have 50 different types of cheese in Ibudar, all of them awesome. So Beslan and Alessian are there too, remember, commiserating on how they should have stayed at home instead of coming on this boring trip. Because remember, Alessian was up drinking all night, so he would much rather have stayed in bed. Much rather. Mm-hmm. But Beslan's like, maybe they're lucky. Maybe smugglers will attack them in the rod. Ambush them, you know? Maybe there'll be some excitement. Like, what fun? And Matt is just like, what the fuck? I don't want your kind of fun. But the dice are still rolling in his head. So he knows that probably will be some fun coming up. Mm-hmm. They disembark in the Rahad. It's still a shithole, as Matt remembers it. And off they go to find the house with the cash in it. Lan is with Nynaeve, and Vannin is with Elaine, as if they were both there, as if he was her warder as well. Mm-hmm. And they are just surrounded by dodgy characters in this area of town. But Matt thinks, and I quote, "Lan would be enough protection for 24 pretty 16-year-old girls carrying bags of gold." So it's like one man. And there's a scene here as well where like guys that are like stroking their daggers look at Lan for like 1 second, and then they look away and they're like, whoa. And the same thing happens with Vannin, which is another reason to like Vannin.
Cool.
People check him out and then like avert their eyes when he makes
this
contact.
This is not
with,
an easy mark.
With him.
Yeah,
like he was a fat dude, but something about him. Mm-hmm. So also, there's wise women with them that helps keep trouble at bay. Everybody in Ibudar respects a wise woman. They see that red belt, and there's women coming up and asking, "Oh, is there anything we can do? Can we help you? Can we carry stuff?" And then everybody's like, "No, it's cool. We're cool." It's an odd bunch, the red arms and Matt and the wise woman and then Elaine and Nynaeve and Lan's there too. It's a big mishmash. So they're making quite a scene walking through there. And finally,
the Queen's son.
Yes, I forgot about him.
A Terran lord.
A Terran lord with his big beard. Yeah. Anyway, so finally, Rhiann leads them to the building. And Elaine's outside as she counts 6 floors, which displeases Nynaeve and confuses Matt. Because remember, this is all from Matt. He's just like, women and why is 6 floors important? But apparently from the world of dreams, she thought it was a 6-floor building. She was right. Mm-hmm. Matt sends Harnan and some men to watch the back entrance. It's a good move. Mm-hmm. And Nynaeve reacts condescendingly, telling him they needn't worry. They've got everything under control here, you know. Wise ones are here. Wise women are here. We're here. You here. It's cool. Chill out. Inside, they start heading up the stairs. But Matt is blocked by Nynaeve and Lan having a conversation and ignoring him completely. Matt tried to interrupt them and says, "Let's get the bloody bowl." And a woman's voice replies behind him like, "Yes, that's a good idea." And it's Fallien Boda and Ispan Shefar. Matt feels his medallion go cold, and Nynaeve tells them that she is shielded. She also mentions that those bitches are Black Aja, by the way. They are responsible for murder. So everybody's like standing on the stairs, and the Black Aja's downstairs, and they've also brought their strong arms, their dark friend strong arms with them. So there's like a kind of like a tense moment of a few seconds where everybody's standing at each other. They should have gagged Nynaeve as well, so she didn't say that, but too late. So while the baddies are giving everybody their bad guy speech, Matt realizes that they are ignoring him and Lan because they just think that they are more hired muscle. They didn't recognize either of them. So Lan just stage dives off the stairs into those bitches, taking them both to the ground, which I thought was fantastic. Getting up to his hands and knees, he's about to be cudgeled as well by some of the dark friend strong arms when Matt stabs the dickhead through the belly. Oh, and it's on like Donkey Kong. So that's the first move, Lan. Of course, the first move is by Lan. Everyone's into the fray now. The Black Sisters, I say, also brought their strong arms. So Nalesian and Breslin had someone to play with. Nynaeve is now unshielded and dropping bodies. I've got like Let the Bodies Hit the Floor playing in my head while this is happening. So the only people not getting into it are the wise women, who are in shock. They're sitting on the stairs, like clutching their little daggers. And Nynaeve shouts at them to start fighting. She needs help because Ispan and Fallien are linked. So they're a bit more than she can handle at the moment. So then there's a scream from upstairs where Elaine had gone up ahead with some others. And Nynaeve looks pleadingly at Matt to tell him that there was channeling upstairs, and she begs him to go help Elaine. Like, Matt's in the thick of things down here, fighting to just, you know, save his ass and everybody else's ass. But Nynaeve's expression and her use of the word please changes his mind, and he flies up the stairs. He bursts through the door on the top floor, in the book it says, into a scene from a nightmare. And now, after Vili's review of his chapter, I was saying, Matt, you should have been last night with Rand to see a scene from a nightmare. This is a bad scene, but it's not last night's scene. Elaine and every other woman is sprawled on the floor, seemingly dead or injured. And Vannon is there too, and he is also down. There is blood pouring out of his nose and ears. When you're bleeding out of your ears, you know shit's bad. The last woman on the floor... the last woman who's not on the floor, my mistake, Janira, runs towards Matt screaming for help, when a plain-looking man grabs her from behind and snaps her neck like a ninja movie style, you know? Yeah. The two-handed neck snap. There are more dark friend strong arms up there, breaking into the cash room, kicking down the door, but Matt figures he should get rid of the, you know, ordinary-looking ninja first, by running at him with his Ashindare extended, like just screaming and running. And the man just flows out of the way. And Matt thinks that he is faster than a Madral. It's so cool that, like, I fought enough Madral to know that this guy's faster than one as well.
Very cool.
Matt has been around and he's like, holy shit, what the fuck is this? The man grabs the shaft of the Ashindare as he slinks out the way and throws Matt with it flying down the hall. I think it's like 5 paces. While Matt is trying to get up and like catch his breath because he's been winded, he sees Nalesian entering the room at that moment, stabbing at the man and seeing the man slide out of the way again and then just shoot his arm out and rip Nalesian's throat out with his bare hand. And there was a collective Nalesian scream from every reader in the world. Oh, Nalesian, you should have stayed in bed. Matt thinks he should have let Nalesian stay dead. And charges and rugby tackles like Peter Steph Dutoy, that golem, taking all three of them to the ground. Poor Nalesian gets taken to the ground as well, but I mean, tough. You're not coming back.
He's from dead already.
Nalesian, I'm sorry. He's dead already. And proceeds to stab the golem in the back and side, the torso in general, several times. But this... I'm going to start calling him a golem now. The golem manages to kind of like turn around inside Matt's grip because he was face down on the ground, if you recall. Matt on his back stabbing him with a dagger. And the golem manages to like turn around in his grip, which should have been impossible, to face Matt and pull the knife from Matt's hand. Matt goes for wrist control. I thought that was cool. Grappling 101. Desperately trying to fight him off, but the golem is just... far too powerful, and just smiles at Matt and tells him he wants you dead as much as he wants her. Can we just clarify who's her?
Elaine?
Elaine.
Elaine? Only Elaine?
Well, who sent the golem? Samael. Samael sent the golem to Carradine to deal with the Aes Sedai, right? And Carradine has already made moves. He sent Elaine the letter saying, I'll escort you to Andor and stuff. He's trying to get Elaine.
Okay.
Potentially that even arrange that kidnapping when they left the Kin's house. You know, that's the one suspect. All right.
Tis true. Okay. So his golem's orders were, kill everyone, bring me the girl.
Mm.
Gotcha. So the golem overpowers Matt. Wrist control did nothing. Going for his head, I assume to pull off another of the ninja movie neck snap maneuvers, when Matt's medallion falls on the golem's face and fries that fucker's skin like bacon.
Mm-hmm.
He throws Matt off him and stands up. Matt, by now, has put two and two together, figures this guy is not a human. And the golem pulls the knife Matt had left under his arm and throws it at him. Matt, who also watches the ninja movies, snatches the blade out of the air because of not the ninja movies. Tom taught him that. He thinks, thanks for teaching me that, Tom.
Uh-huh.
But that's also a cool move, like pulls a knife out and then throws it at him and he snatches it out of the air. Matt is just fucking awesome.
Yep.
And this is when Matt notices there is no blood on the knife and then his heart sinks. Oh, fuck. I knew this guy wasn't human, but this is weird. Like, there should be at least some, but this is a bloodless dude. By now, the Dark Friend's strong arms are like filing out of there with their arms full of junk from the cash room, and Elaine is starting to wake up. He notices from the corner of his eye, sees her move. So both he and the golem see her moving.
Hmm.
The golem then gives him one of those horrible smiles and turns towards Elaine. Matt tells him, you can't have her, and breaks the cord holding the medallion around his neck and starts spinning it around in front of him as a weapon, repeating, you can't bloody have her. As he takes a step towards the golem, the golem's smile fades as he can't take his eyes off that spinning medallion. And there's a window behind the backtracking golem now, which Matt thinks, maybe I should try and push him towards the window and try and dropping him out. Maybe a 6-story drop will do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
Spoilers, it won't. But the golem is too fast and darts into one of the side rooms. The golem figures, fuck this noise. I don't know what that medallion is. I'm not playing with it anymore. And runs into a side room and pulls the door closed after him. Matt's like, no, you're coming with me, buddy, and kicks the door down, two kicks. And when the door breaks off its hinges and falls down, there's nothing and nobody in the room. Only an opening of a rat hole next to that broken mirror, Vili.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the broken mirror is. But there's no windows, there's nothing, just a rat hole. Dun, dun, dun. Elaine calls out Matt's name, so he rushes over there to help her up, and she tells him that the one power flows just melted away around that guy, like his medallion, the exact same thing. So there we go. Similar powers fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
She looks into his eyes and she thanks him profusely, telling him that she has so much toe towards him now, but that she's not going to let him beat her, and that he'll just have to let her save his life instead. And Matt's just going, what the fuck are you talking about?
His response is, I'll see what I can arrange.
But inside, he's just like, another crazy woman in my crazy life. Toe and white beater? What the fuck is going on?
He must know about so this is anyway. When... You spend enough time with that eel. I mean, he had lady
eel. Yeah, but he's not expecting it from Elaine. That's like, why is Elaine talking about toe?
We can get into this, but Matt, his whole thing is like he does everything for everyone else, but he thinks that's normal and he doesn't expect anything in return. Like he doesn't feel like he's doing anything that special.
Yeah, he's no bloody hero.
No.
So yeah, he saved her. She's all right. She's crazy. And this is when she notices, Elaine, that is, all the other women laying on the ground. She sways like a red arm, which kind of shocks Matt a bit, but you know, the situation calls for it. And she rushes over to them. She reaches Rianne first and delves her, but she's not good enough to do anything about healing at this stage. Her skills are not advanced enough. So she screams for Nynaeve, who's actually just coming up through the door, having dealt with their black Azure assholes below off screen. We didn't see what happened there, but they came out on top. Nynaeve tells her, like, I'm here, no need to scream like a cat. and then turns around and screams like a cat down the stairs.
Yes.
to tell the women, like, you better hold on to them. Don't fuck it up. Don't let them escape. Well, you'll have to deal with me, blah, 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 blah. Uh-huh. She turns around and Nynaeve, like, for the first time, sees all the chaos in the room and just, you know, starts getting to work. Jhaenyra, she got her neck snapped. She's dead. She's not. There's no healing that's going to bring her back. Mm. Tamarla also needs a specialized attention. Nynaeve starts questioning Matt about what happened when Sumiko comes in and runs over to Rhiann. Yeah, she is. It's a healing fest happening here.
It would be Sumiko and Samitsu, like both almost Japanese sounding S names that have the same number of vowels and consonants. It's just both are really difficult. Good at healing. Cool. Thanks, Robert, for helping me out there.
Maybe he was trying to help you out. So, like, if you can just, if you know, like, what's the name of that special super healer? Doesn't matter. Sumiko, Sumitsu, something like that.
Something like
that. You'll be right either way. So she performs, this is Sumiko, performs her own style of healing, which at first freaks Nynaeve out. But Nynaeve is busy working on Tamarla, I think, at the time. And she looks over. So she doesn't stop working. But she's like, first, like, what the hell are you doing? It's just kind of like freaked out by what's happening. But she's noticing, like, that what's happening is something she's never seen before. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. So she's impressed. And after the healing's done, you know, Nynaeve tells her, like, no, like, don't stop, you know, like, continue healing. But there'll be many sisters that will want to learn from you. And this blows Sumiko's mind, being so in awe of Aes Sedai, you know, these kin. Like, her jaw hits the floor. She's like, learn from me? And I'm like, oh, sweet, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Elaine starts looking, like, Nynaeve says, well, Elaine, if you're not going to fucking do anything, get up and start looking for the bowl as well. You seem fine. So Elaine starts, she's like, yeah, I'll go look for the bowl. So the room starts to fill up at this point as well. The other wise women come up the stairs. There's Red Arms. Beslin's there. Lan joins them as well. And Beslin has a sad look at Nalesian. You know, he's like, fuck. You know, they were buddies, I would imagine.
They were getting quite chummy.
Yeah, so there's another kin woman there. Her name is Aiene. It's Iene. Like, why, Robert? Why? This woman has Ispen Shafar shielded and holding her one arm twisted up behind her back and the other one grabbing her behind the neck. Just like pushing her forward into the room. She's gone. I think she was the one on the steps that was cowering. You know, when Nynaeve shouted at them. So gone from that from the scouring on the steps to dominating a fully trained Aes Sedai turned dark friend. Mm-hmm. She's terrified but determined. And she's like, fucking, like, I'm in it now, man. Yes. And Matt starts questioning Harnen about what happened out back. Harnen's upstairs as well. And Harnen's just like, we were overwhelmed. We were surprised. Whole bunch of dark friends, strong arms, knives and everything. And some guy who moved like a snake. And Matt's like, oh, fuck, the golem got out. So that's where he was. He went out the back way. Anyway, everyone that Matt sent around the back of the house is dead. And Harnen is alive. He's the only survivor. He's kind of fingering a wound that he has in his shoulder that Nynaeve managed to heal somewhere along the line. She bumped into him and healed him. So thanks to her, he is the only survivor of the guys watching the back. Rhiann, Vannon and Tamarla are also now fine, by the way. They've all been healed. The way, like, the healing sisters took care of them in their own unique ways. Everyone's, you know, healing. In total, there are two dead wise women, Jhaenyra and Melore, who Matt laments he won't be able to stare at her bosom anymore. Like, all right. Okay. And then there are also six dead red shirts, red arms. So all of that's happened. That's an account of the dead. Elaine exclaims, I found it! Coming out of the room with a wide, flat bowl shape wrapped in a cloth. She tells Nynaeve, we have the bowl! We found the bowl! Hooray! There's much rejoicing. Matt's just like, well, then let's get the fuck out of here. And no one argues. Mm-hmm. And off they go. On the way out, recruiting some men to help them move the dead wise women corpses as they head down to the river quickly. And that's the end of the chapter.
Whoa. The Bowl of the Winds.
A lot of chapter.
Bowl of the Winds. A lot of chapter.
Mm. You guys had two big ones there. I think they were both close to 30 pages. Mm.
30 thoroughly enjoyable pages. I'll read them again.
Yeah, I mean, Crown of Swords just keeps delivering, eh? Next. This is not even the fight in Shadow Logoth. You know, like, there's still an actual climax is still coming.
I couldn't stop. I just had to keep going. And it's like, eventually, look now, you've got to go to other stuff. Stop now.
Mm-hmm. You've got to go do things. Live your life. Go to work. So, yeah, fun.
Vili, did you have anything you want to lob in there?
Matt being Matt. I mean, you just every chapter with him is always enjoyable. There'll always be something to laugh at. And I thoroughly laughed at quite a few things while reading this. I was like, this is great. So it is a funny chapter. He is so enjoyable.
There's a reason he's my favorite.
Everyone's favorite.
So that chapter icon of the two Aes Sedai faces, or the two female faces, the black and the white, that's the Black Archer icon.
Is it? Are you saying or asking?
Half of each. Bit of column A, bit of column B.
Your voice rose at the end, making it sound like a question. I'm Ron Burgundy?
Exactly. even Matt thinks that Ibudar has too many festivals and feasts. This is Matt.
Matt.
He's changing. He says, I'm changing and I don't like it.
Especially like when they get to the Rahad. Oh, what does he say? Mm. He shudders at the thought of taking the woman to the golden crown of heaven, and then realizes what he's doing and shudders at shuddering. Like, he's like, what's happening to me? Why am I repulsed by the idea of taking these women into a scummy pub? Like, that never used to bother me. There's a part earlier where Nynaeve grabs her braid as if to tug at it, but then her hands fall away and she wrings her hands instead. Is it because now that she's married, she wants to sort of leave her sort of childish habits and stuff behind? Like, she's never done that. We've never seen her do that. And the thing that's changed most recently is being married, or block is broken. Or no.
I read it differently. No, I read it as just she was going to get angry and realized she wasn't. Or she wasn't really angry. She was just going to put on airs. And then like her instinct is to be angry and grab it, and then realize, I can't be angry at Lan. I love him.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Because again, it's put in there, and what's it trying to tell
me? Yes.
I had the same note, Joe, when Matt starts ranting about Mogidi and the dude in the background, like offloading the boat, like just falling in the water.
What the?
Matt thinks that Beslan and Alessian aren't surreptitious enough when they are checking out women. He, on the other hand, was very discreet. He knew how to do it just so that they don't notice. Jesus, Matt.
Yes, Matt.
You're not as good as you think, Matt.
No.
They notice. That's why they're looking at him, why they look at him with dirty looks, because he thinks...
They know he's a lecher. Like,
yeah, because they saw you looking. You think they didn't see you?
Yes. When Lan has dive-bombed those dudes, he gets up and he cleaves a dark friend from crotch to neck.
Oh, yes.
That's not a good way to be cleaved.
Very nice. I don't think there is a good way to be cleaved, but I mean, that's the last cleaving I would like.
That's like the whole torso, but in an upward motion. So like the strength he can generate on those upward strokes is...
What is that? Undercuts the something? Isn't there? There's an undercut. What's that?
The river undercuts the bank?
Oh, river undercuts the bank, you think?
A sweep.
That's a horizontal one.
Yeah, this is a horizontal one. Moon rising over the...
Oh, yeah, maybe something like that. No. Yes, there's rising. Heron rising from the rushes, or no, that's wading through the rushes.
Heron slices bell open. Falls to ground.
Yeah, these moves should be more aptly named to make things clearer.
Spilling of the gut. Leading of
Heron
the
spills
kidney.
Heron spills its guts.
Neck. I like that Matt is so intent on keeping his promise. He's just figured out this thing that has superhuman strength and no blood and has murdered everyone in this hallway is about to kill Elaine. His promise that he made Rand is what he's like. You can't have her. I made a promise.
No. Yeah. Because when he gets up there, he sees her. He thinks immediately, I failed. He thinks she's dead.
Yeah.
Everyone's dead. I'm too late.
Yeah. And Matt goes back into his default mode of keeping his word. which is great because it's like such an polarizing way for Matt to be. Like everyone looks at him as this like cheeky, like maybe not so honest man of low moral fiber, when he has some of the most like rigid principles in the story and goes above and beyond to stick to those, which is cool. Yeah, and then my last point was just Matt and Elaine, like how cool it is that Elaine, like it seems like she finally gives him an actual apology. Here, there's no act anymore. She's like, Matt, thank you. I truly owe you. You've saved my life again. You're going to have to let me save yours at least once. I have so much toe to you. And that's when Matt goes, I'll see what I can arrange, you crazy bitch. but that's it from me. Anything else?
No, I think that my 13 pages and 1,790 words is everything I'm going to say on the subject.
Okay. So a brief one then.
Yeah, just touching on the key points.
Well, speaking of key points, did you pick a favorite moment?
I sure did.
Of course. Of course I did.
Okay, Joe, why don't you tell us first this time?
It's Matt, of course.
Default favorite
moment. You can't have her. You can't bloody have her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I will. I'm gonna die here today before I let you take her.
Very cool.
That and repeating the line, but putting a bloody in there.
Yes,
it's Matt
against this thing that he has never encountered. Like he has no idea how he's gonna kill it. He knows the medallion can hurt it, but also swinging a medallion at a person is also not a very effective weapon, right? Like it doesn't seem very threatening.
But he can. That thing is like terrified of him at that point. So he knows, like he can look at the golem's face and go like, all right, this thing does actually scare him. But I mean, he had just been on the ground tackling this thing and felt its power and felt, and he's absolutely out of his league. There's no contest. And he still stands there and takes a step. Because the thing is, he's spinning that thing and he says, you can't have her. And then forces himself to start walking towards this thing.
Yeah.
Woo! Balls of steel, man.
The golem must be afraid because it would not be used to feeling any kind of damage from anything. What the fuck is going on here?
Yeah. Feeling damage for the first time.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Vil?
You can kill it. My favorite moment is not a Matt one. My favorite moment is a Finn one. Flynn. Dharma Flynn telling his story, which was really ingratiating, like it draws you in all while he's weaving some surgery and then doesn't finish the story and just leaves you on the cliffhanger. It's like, okay, cool, it's done. And then blows Miko's mind completely where she offers him her womb. That is...
Sumitsu.
There it happened. Immediately.
Oh, Billy, that is a great moment and also my favorite.
Yeah.
No, that is the moment for me. It is just so good. It was everything for me. Like just
the whole little scene and everything.
The story, the whole like all of a sudden you see why RJ is such a good writer. Like all of a sudden I just want to hear his story. Like okay, yes. 15 wounds. Did you heal yourself? When is it good? When are you gonna drop the penny? And then I just needed to speak through while I did this thing.
And also like how the women in the room, the Aes Sedai and Amis, are like very wary of these men that can channel for, you know, all the reasons that have been stated over and over and over before, but then are just like blown away by what Flynn has been able to achieve here. And also obviously the impact of what Flynn has achieved here. Like he saved our protagonist, you know, no more story after this if it's not for Flynn.
Rand was busy. I don't think we focused very hard on the fact that Rand nearly died. I mean, he nearly ended.
Very close.
he had a sepsis episode and you did some ICU time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All about.
I was just thinking now the similarities between Flynn and House. It's like grizzly older dudes with a limp that are really good at healing people. But just House is a dickhead and Flynn is a really nice guy. So that's where the similarity ends.
Yeah. J, you guys have any honorable mentions? I have three.
I'm going to stick to just having my one moment.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of it, but after our conversation, I would have to say, Darlin, like stepping up, honorable mention.
That is also cool. The Amis and Cadswain interaction to me was a highlight.
Oh, that too.
Also, the sword fight and just how chill Rand was with everything that Ryton threw at him. That also just felt good. That appealed to my 16-year-old, you know, brain.
Yeah.
And Matt and Elaine's interactions here. Like, Elaine sort of finally understanding what's happening with Tylan, and then at the end here being like, finally, like, giving him a proper thank you and showing her appreciation. Like, I love Matt and Elaine's interactions.
Mm.
Because of their similarities. And this even, I don't think we mentioned it, but when they're speaking earlier, before they get onto the coaches and stuff, Matt swears about the queen, like, oh, you know, something. And then you could swear Elaine sort of mouthed the words herself. If he didn't know any better, he would have said that she was trying to remember them. And I just love the fact
she's trying it out, like, storing that away for later.
Can't swallow or something, something along those lines. But I just love their interactions, Matt and Elaine, especially because of Matt's sort of like his preconceived notion or lack of appreciation for any kind of nobles. So like Elaine being the daughter heir is always going to be on the back foot when she deals with Matt because of Matt's, you know, attitude towards nobles. So it just sets up their little interplay for constant friction and to and fro. All righty then, enough from me to our listeners. Why don't you send us your favorite moments, your theories, your corrections, your shower thoughts, whatever you want. But importantly, our next episode will be our Crown of Swords finale. So along with sending in your thoughts and favorite moments and things about the next stretch of chapters, also send us what you think about the book as a whole, because that's what we will be doing after we have covered the chapters. We'll be talking about them as we always do at the end of a book, but then we'll also talk about the book as a whole, what we liked about it, what we didn't like, and where it sort of falls for us in the ranking. We won't make it an official ranking, but how we feel about the book compared to the others.
All 8 days of it.
Yes, exactly. That's going to come up, right? We'll talk about that. To our listeners, you can send all of those thoughts and theories in using the social media links in the episode description below. And then, next time on Blood and Ashes, we will cover chapters 39 through to the end of chapter 41. That wasn't too much of a cliffhanger. Those are the only three chapters left, and we will cover all three of them. That is, chapter 39 is called Promises to Keep, and then chapter 41 is called A Crown of Swords. A fitting name for the final chapter of A Crown of Swords?
Yes.
Mm.
So to you two gentlemen, remember to send in your, or at least take notes. Don't send them in to me. That would be weird. To write down notes about your thoughts about the book and everything else as well, which we will discuss next time. But until then, I shall say, sleep well and wake.
Cheerio, everyone.
2023 World Cup champs.
Well.